We introduced last time the metric, and the metric is a crucial structure to put on a manifold because it gives the manifold shape. And how does it do it? Well, by describing infinitesimal distances and therefore also finite distances. And if you have a notion of finite distances, you can describe the shape of a thing. For example, if this is some curved manifold here, then if you draw a triangle with a right angle in it, well, then Pythagoras may not hold. In general, it will not hold, Pythagoras' theorem. And so by just measuring distances, you can find out, oh, this is not a flat space. You could also measure the sum of the angles, and if it doesn't sum up to 180 degrees for a triangle, then again, you know, there is some shape to this thing. This is not just flat. So the metric is a key concept that can be used to give a manifold its shape. And again, it works by explaining infinitesimal distances. And then you can integrate them up to get finite distances. And from that, you can verify whether or not there is a shape that's non-trivial. And as we will later see, from the metric, you can calculate also the curvature tensor. And so you can make all of that much more explicit than I was just saying it hand-wavingly with the triangles. There is another way to describe the shape of a manifold that has nothing to do with the metric, has nothing to do with distances. And that's what we will do today. And this other way works in the following, by the following method. Imagine looking down on the Earth from above the North Pole, like this. Okay, so you look onto the Earth, straight down onto the North Pole. And then let's say the outer circle is the equator, and the more inner circle is somewhere between the North Pole and the equator. So what you could do is, standing on the North Pole, you stretch out your arm like this, and you point south, let's say. You point south. Which is easy, because whichever direction you point to is south. And then you start walking, always parallel transporting your arm, like this. You just go like this. You don't go like that. No, no, no. You keep it straight, right? And then you make it all the way down to either the equator or maybe somewhere between the North Pole and the equator. Doesn't really matter. At some point, you stop. And then you walk along that latitude line, constant latitude line, right? Which could be the equator, for example. But it doesn't really matter at what latitude you do that. And again, you don't turn around or anything. No, at the moment you arrive, let's say, at the equator, you just walk along the equator now. So you never purposely change the direction of your arm. And then at some point, you reverse gear and you go back to the North Pole. Again, not on purpose moving your arm. But of course, if you pointed in this direction when you left, you will be pointing in that direction when you arrive. That would never happen if you had walked on a flat surface, where if you just walk whatever shape, triangular or rectangular, if you don't move your arm, you're pointing in the same direction after you return than the direction you started in. Which means that the parallel transport of vectors, if non-trivial, indicates or is a witness of the presence of some sort of shape, some sort of curvature. I'm a bit hesitant to use the term curvature because it's a technical term that we haven't introduced yet. Okay, so we can use parallel transport to indicate the presence of non-trivial shape of a manifold. And there is a mathematical concept that's based on that. So it's not based on metric at all. It's based on that alone. So in today's lecture, we will neglect that we have already introduced the metric way of describing the shape of a manifold. We will introduce a new way to describe the shape of a manifold. Of course, eventually, we will find out that the two methods are the same, and we will find out what it takes mathematically to make sure that the shape described in this way is the shape described in that way. But for now, let's just neglect that we know what a metric is. We don't need it. And instead, we describe the shape in this way. We introduce a concept for that purpose. And what is it going to be? Well, you might not be surprised that it's another derivative that we will introduce, yet another derivation. It's a so-called covariant derivation. And the point here is that the covariant covariant derivative captures the extent to which it is non-trivial when you parallel transport a vector. So you parallel transport that vector, and well, maybe the parallel transport is not so trivial. So it's the description of the infinitesimal parallel transport. Just like the metric captures infinitesimal distances, which you can integrate and check whether Pythagoras holds, the covariant derivative tells you about infinitesimal parallel transport, and which you can then integrate up to find a finite angle of rotation if you go around a circle. Now, you may wonder, OK, but don't we already have a derivative that kind of is sensitive to directions? So because this is going to be a directional derivative, right? So what if I parallel transport a vector in this direction? What if I parallel transport it in that direction? And we have the Lie derivative. So how come we don't just use the Lie derivative? We can differentiate vectors using the Lie derivative in a particular direction. We can differentiate a vector field in a particular direction of another vector field. But remember that the Lie derivative is actually insensitive to the metric. We introduced the metric later. We introduced the Lie derivative first, before we had a metric, which means that the Lie derivative is completely insensitive to the metric. It is completely insensitive to the shape of the manifold. So that's not it. And we can see that also in the following. When you take the commutator of the Lie derivative. So we Lie differentiate in the Xi 1 direction. And then we Lie differentiate in the Xi 2 direction. And we compare that with doing it the other way around. So it's the commutator of two Lie derivatives. Then it's the Lie derivative of the commutator. That was one of those formulas that we had, which is always 0, because the partial derivatives commute. And so that will be different now that we are interested in the parallel transport, because what we see from this, it does matter, you know, whether we first, it matters how we parallel transport. The path by which we parallel transport matters, and so we expect a non-commutativity for the analog of this. All right, so what we want to do is introduce a derivative, the so-called covariant derivative, which captures the notion of parallel transport of a vector, taking into account or describing the non-triviality of the shape. So that's going to be the covariant differentiation indicated with the symbol nabla. And the definition is that any linear map of tangent vector fields, which takes a tangent vector field, one tangent vector field, which will indicate the direction in which we differentiate, and another tangent vector field, which is the vector field that we want to parallel transport infinitesimally, and maps that into a tangent vector field, which is the infinitesimal change of that vector field under parallel transport. Any such map which takes two tangent vector fields in and outputs one tangent vector field, which we will indicate with a nabla, just like the Lie derivative had a subscript psi for the direction in which we differentiate, the nabla too will have a subscript psi to indicate the direction in which we differentiate. And what we're differentiating is the thing that's afterwards. And in this case, it's the eta, which is some tangent vector field. So any linear map of two tangent vector fields into tangent vector fields, which obeys these two conditions, will be called a covariant differentiation. And what are these conditions? Now, the first condition, well, let's start with the second one. The second one is simply a Leibniz rule. It says that if you covariantly differentiate in the xi direction, the product of a function and a tangent vector field, then we want a Leibniz rule to apply. We want the Leibniz rule to apply, which means we want to have the covariant derivative of the function times the vector field plus the function times the covariant derivative of the vector field, where we define the covariant derivative of the function to be trivially just the evaluation of the vector field on the function. The reason is that the parallel transport of a scalar function ought to be trivial. It ought to, because there is no, there is no non-triviality of parallel transport because the scalar doesn't point in any direction. So what that means is we simply, for the covariant derivative of a scalar function, we simply recruit the directional derivative. Okay, so we define the covariant derivative of a function in the xi direction to be the evaluation of xi, a tangent vector is a directional derivative, on that function. Okay, so we want the Leibniz rule in the sense that when the covariant derivative acts on a function times a vector field, we get the ordinary directional derivative xi acting on the function times the vector field plus carrying forward the function unchanged and then differentiating the tangent vector field. And the other condition that we require for a covariant differentiation is that when we covariantly differentiate a vector field in the direction of a scalar function times the vector field, so in other words, if we scale the vector field in whose direction we are differentiating, then that scaling should be trivially, we should be able to just trivially pull that in front of the differentiation. Okay, so whenever there's a function here, then we can just pull that in front. What that means is that we choose a derivative, and then we choose the direction to differentiate in, and then if we take that direction vector and multiply it with 5, then we get 5 times the amount of covariant derivative. You may think that's kind of trivial, but it's not, because remember that the Lie derivative also obeys this. It doesn't obey that, though. The Lie derivative doesn't obey that. The Lie derivative instead is all about the vector fields of directions catching derivatives onto another. And so for the Lie derivative, this is not true, because the Lie derivative of f xi, the Lie derivative of a vector field eta in a direction of f xi is the commutator of f xi with eta. Remember, we had that over here already. And that commutator is generally not, you can't just pull the f out, because the xi and the eta are derivatives which act on the f, so you can't pull that out. But that is what you would need to have in order for this to be obeyed. So that's where they differ. And in a sense, the covariant derivative is much easier in that regard, because whenever we have a coefficient function, for example, we can just pull it in front. Right? So xi, for example, might be one of the basis vectors of the tangent space, d by dx2 or something. And that might be a coefficient function. Coefficient function just immediately just can be pulled out. All right, the covariant derivative is also going by another name. It's also called an affine connection. And this is all we need to describe, in fact, the shape of a manifold, its curvature and all of that. So even if we never introduce a metric, we can still describe black holes and cosmology and all of that, and just in terms of this. So for now, let's assume we haven't even defined the metric yet. We will later make the connection between the metric description and the affine connection or covariant differentiation description of the same manifolds. Now, how does a covariant differentiation, you see, on the same differentiable manifold, you can define many metrics, because you can, on the same differentiable manifold, you can describe, you can give it many different shapes. The differential manifold is just telling you about the structure of the coordinate systems you can put on it. But the different metrics, you can put different metrics on it, and then one time you describe Minkowski space, another time a black hole, or an expanding space-time of gravitational waves. They all just differ by the metric field that you put on it. But you can also define different covariant differentiations, and each choice of such a linear map is a choice of giving the differentiable manifold a shape. Okay, so how do we actually specify such a thing? How do we actually choose one of these covariant differentiations? Obviously, we want to do that in coordinates, because then it's not just abstract stuff that we write down, but then we can make things much more explicit. So how can we do that? Well, let's express this stuff in bases for the in coordinate systems and in bases. So let's say we choose for the tangent space at the point x the usual basis of d by dxi. We don't have to choose that basis, but we can choose that basis. So let's do that for convenience. Then, given a covariant derivative nabla, we can look at its action on these basis vectors. So a nabla is given by its action on basis vectors. Let's say I choose a basis vector for the direction into which I want to differentiate, and a basis vector as an example of what I may want to differentiate. And I should get out some tangent vector out of this. So to specify what one of these covariant differentiations does, I write down the covariant derivative in the direction of, let's say, the basis vector d by dxi, the covariant derivative in this direction of this basis vector. Right? So I choose a partial derivative for this tangent vector and a partial derivative for that tangent vector. And then I know that the output is going to be some tangent vector. Here we have two indices. And the output has to be a tangent vector. So it has to be a linear combination of these guys. So therefore, whatever it is, it has to be of that form. There's got to be some function gamma kij of x contracted with these basis vectors, right? Because every tangent vector is a linear combination of these guys. So we have gamma k and then this d by dxk. And we can get a different tangent vector for every choice of I and j. So we get this three symbol object here, the so-called Christoffel symbols, that describe the covariant differentiation. So if you have a differentiable manifold and you want to give it a shape, this is how you do it. You just invent such Christoffel symbol functions with indices kij of x, make them some wild functions, and bang, you have covariant differentiation, you have a notion of parallel transport, you've given your manifold a shape. It's effectively the same strategy as if you had given your manifold a metric. Then too, you give it a shape. Now, once you've specified that, you've specified everything about this covariant differentiation, because we have these axioms. So we know then, for example, that if we covariantly differentiate an arbitrary vector field eta in the direction of an arbitrary vector field psi, then we can evaluate it just using the axioms and the input of these functions that we came up with. So how do we evaluate that? Well, first, let's spell out what this is. So it's the covariant derivative of a vector field eta. The vector field eta can always be written in this way, where the eta j are scalar coefficient functions. Remember, this is a vector. These guys are coefficient functions. They are number valued, so they are scalar. And same here, the tangent vector xi is some coefficient function xi of x times d by dxi. Now, from this axiom, we know that since here we have a vector, here we have a scalar function, that scalar function can be pulled in front. So we can write this as, by axiom number one, we can pull these xi I functions here in front. So we just have the covariant derivative in the d by dxi direction of that vector field. Remember, these are functions. These are vectors. So now we can apply axiom number two, which tells us what happens when we covariantly differentiate a function times a vector. Here we have coefficient function times a vector. So carrying forward, we have the xi I here. And then we have the covariant derivative of eta times, leaving this the same by the Leibniz rule, plus the term where we leave the coefficient function the same and we differentiate we covariantly differentiate the vector. Okay, so the two terms are the covariant derivative of the coefficient function. But remember that the covariant derivative of the coefficient function is defined to be just the evaluation of the tangent vector on the function. So that means that the covariant derivative of eta subscript j is just the ordinary derivative in the xi direction of eta. So we write this as eta superscript j, comma I. Remember that the comma I means partial derivative in the xi direction, right? So it's just evaluating that derivative on this coefficient function. That's the first term of the Leibniz rule. So we apply this covariant derivative on a coefficient function, but the covariant derivative on a function is just the ordinary derivative on the function. So we get this expression here and carry forward the d by dxj, because that's not being differentiated in the first term of the Leibniz rule. But in the second term of the Leibniz rule, we carry forward the xi I, of course, but also we carry forward the eta j, and we covariantly differentiate the vector d by dxj in the direction of d by dxi. And that's what we just defined. So we can write this as eta j, I mean xi I, eta j, and then here we have these Christoffel symbols, d by dxk. Now by renaming this index j as k, we see that we have a d by dxk here and a d by dxk there. And so we can succinctly put that expression here into this form, where we have xi I and then the ordinary derivative of the coefficient function plus, and here we have again the xi I and then this part that comes from the covariant differentiation, from the non-triviality of the covariant differentiation. You see, what this expresses is that if you differentiate this vector field in that direction, you may get something non-trivial. If this was flat space and just Cartesian coordinates, we would expect this to be zero on the right-hand side. And so what we obtain is that when we differentiate a vector field eta in the xi direction, then if this was flat space and Cartesian coordinates, then that gamma term would be absent, and we would simply have that the derivative of the d by dxj in the d by dx, that the derivative of eta in the xi direction is just given by this ordinary derivative here. Maybe it's just differentiating eta in the xi direction. Now, since this expression will come up a lot, where we have not just the ordinary derivative of eta, but we also have this affine connection addition to the derivative, we will introduce a notation for that. And we will say, OK, this is the ordinary derivative, where you just take the partial derivative of eta with respect to I. But if you do the covariant derivative, then we'll say that what we obtain, this thing here, we write it as eta k and then subscript semicolon I. So the semicolon I means that we are not simply differentiating the eta in the I direction. No, we also add this affine connection term. That's the covariant derivative. It consists of an ordinary derivative plus an extra term that comes from the affine connection. If you are familiar with the gauge principle in electrodynamics or QCD or the weak interaction, it's very similar. And there you would have that the role of the gamma is played by the gauge field. It's like the A mu in electromagnetism, where, if you remember, the momentum is no longer just minus I h bar d by dx. It's minus I h bar d by dx, that's like that part, plus E times A, right? The gauge field. So if you're familiar with gauge theory, then the gamma is like the gauge field here. Okay, and that means that we can write this equation here, namely that the covariant derivative of the eta in the direction of the eta tangent field in the direction of the xi tangent field. We can write this succinctly using the semicolon notation as xi I eta k and then semicolon I d by dx k, because the semicolon I is all of this. That means all of this, sorry, all of this. Okay, now an important observation here is that these Christoffel symbols do not transform tensorially when we change chart. Let's verify that that's the case, that this is not a tensor. It would look as if it was a one-fold contravariant, two-fold covariant tensor, but it's not. And to see this, let's just calculate the covariant derivative of the tangent vector field d by dx bar b, where we use barred coordinates or another coordinate system, another chart. And we covariant differentiate that in the direction of d by dx a. So we have d by dx bar a and d by dx bar b. And then what we obtain is in this coordinate system is that this is some affine connection, right? So there's got to be some Christoffel symbols that we will call gamma bar times that. So it's just like this formula here, but it's the formula in the other coordinate system, the barred coordinate system. Now we do know how this is transforming under change of coordinates. Namely, under change of coordinates, we know that from the physicist's perspective, we obtain this Jacobian matrix here. Remember, if you don't remember by heart whether it's dx by dx bar or dx bar by dx, remember, it always has to be such that you could cancel this to obtain just the d by dx bar. Now, on the other hand, we could say, yes, we know that. But we also know how this looks in the other bases and how that looks in the other bases. So we can write the covariant derivative with respect to dx bar, the covariant derivative of d by dx bar b in the direction of d by dx bar a using the transformation rules. We obtain that this is this expression here with the Jacobian matrix here and the Jacobian matrix there if we re-express it in terms of the unbarred coordinates. Now, by one of our axioms, namely this one, by axiom number one, we can pull scalar factors in front without differentiating them. And these Jacobian matrix entries are just coefficient functions. This is a vector, but this is just numbers. We can pull that in front. So we go from here to there. And then here we can apply the Leibniz rule, right? Because this is a function. I mean, for each j and b, it's a function. It's just the matrix element function. And that's a vector. So what we obtain is that we can carry this one forward. And then we have a big bracket where we get two terms. One term where we covariantly differentiate these functions, but that's just the ordinary derivative of these functions. So we have the ordinary derivative in the I direction of these functions here, carrying that forward. And then we have a term where we carry that matrix forward, and we differentiate that. But the covariant derivative of this basis vector in the direction of that basis vector is given by the unbarred Christoffel symbol, so we get this expression here. Now we can rewrite that in this form. And what we see is that we obtain, in principle, just a sec, let's compare now. Let's compare now this line here with that line over here. Maybe I should just mention that the d by dx I, d by dx I here, you know, that term contracts. It just becomes a d by dx bar a, right, by the chain rule. That's how that simplifies into this. And that's just carried forward here. So now, if we compare 1 and 2, we obtain that the transformation rules for the Christoffel symbol, the transformation rule is that the barred quantity is given by this expression arising from here plus that expression here. Let's now multiply that equation from the right with the inverse of that Jacobian matrix. And then we obtain that the barred Christoffel symbols are given by this expression plus that expression which involves the affine connection. Now, if that term was absent, we would be saying, oh, everything is good. This is a one-fold contravariant, two-fold covariant tensor because the transformation rule for the upper index is with a K, is this Jacobian matrix, as it should be for a contravariant index. And those two Jacobian matrices properly transform the two lower indices to get us this A and B. So if the gamma, if the Christoffel symbol was tensorial, then that term should be absent. But it is there. So this term is there, which indicates that the gammas are not a tensor. They don't form, the gamma kij are not the coefficient functions of a tensor. We will later in the course find out what it is, but for now we don't have the terminology for that. It's just the set of coefficient functions for now, coefficient functions of an affine connection. And so physicists like Einstein and Riemann would say, okay, this means that whenever an object or a matrix with three coefficients, with three indices, has this transformation property, then we will not call it a tensor. We will call it an affine connection, just by the physicist's definition. But of course, we should go by this definition because it doesn't refer to changes to any coordinate system. It doesn't refer to any changes of bases and so on. The real definition of a, the most useful definition of an affine connection is it's a linear map that obeys these two axioms. And it is explicitly defined by choosing any basis, and it doesn't have to be these bases of the cotangent space, but any basis. And then in that arbitrary basis, you explain how what the covariant derivative is of one basis vector in the direction of the other basis vector. You get Christoffel symbols. And then having defined that, using the axioms, you know how it acts on all vector fields in all directions. Okay, so that's the definition of the covariant derivative. Now, there's also the notion of the absolute covariant derivative. Now, that's a trivial generalization of the notion of covariant derivative. When we define a covariant derivative, then we say it's a linear map that takes two vectors in and outputs one vector. Right? It takes in a vector that is to be differentiated. And it also takes in the direction in which we want to differentiate. And then the output is the differentiated vector, the derivative of that vector. The absolute covariant derivative simply says, let's delay the choice of direction in which we want to differentiate. So we want to differentiate first and then decide later in which direction we want to have differentiated. And the way this works is this. The covariant derivative, withholding the choice of direction in which we want to differentiate, becomes, and we use the same symbol for that, becomes a map that differentiates a tangent vector field to obtain a 1-1 tensor field, which is one-fold contravariant, one-fold covariant. And that's the derivative of that. Now you may wonder, okay, so what about that covariant index down there? Why do we need that covariant index down here? Why is the absolute covariant derivative of a vector field a 1-1 tensor, one-fold contravariant, one-fold covariant? Well, it is one-fold covariant because that's an opening, that's a port in which you can plug in your choice of direction in which you want to have differentiated. So if we apply the covariant derivative on a tangent vector field eta, then it's being mapped into nabla eta, which is going to be eta k, and then the semicolon I of x dxi tensor this basis vector here. How is this doing the job? Let's see what this does. We can take the absolute covariant derivative of a vector field, and then we plug the vector field xi, the direction in which we want to differentiate, we plug it into the covariant entry here. We plug it into these dxi, because these are basis vectors in the cotangent space. Those can eat up a tangent vector field. Let's do that. So we take the covariant derivative of a tangent vector field, defined in exactly this way, where you just have the covariant derivative of these coefficients. So you take this expression, and then you plug xi into that covariant port, right? Into this covariant basis vectors, cotangent space basis vectors. Now, what is that? Dxi onto the xi. Well, that's xi applied to the coefficient function, right? Remember that if you have a differential of a function acting on a tangent vector field, that's the tangent vector field acting on that function. So dxi on xi is xi acting on the function, in this case, the coordinate function. But this is, well, xi is some coefficient functions xi j, and then d by dxj xi, that just gives us the Kronecker delta, and that just gives us xi I. So this just gives us the coefficient of xi in the I direction. And then d by dxk. So what we get is this expression here. And if you remember, that's what we got earlier. Here, right? The covariant derivative of eta in the xi direction is this expression, which is also what we just found here. So if we define the absolute covariant derivative of a vector field to be this, where instead of already contracting with xi, we just put the dxi here, then we can choose later in which direction we want to have covariantly differentiated, plug that in, and then the whole thing reduces to the exact same expression as what we had before. It reduces to the covariant derivative of eta in the xi direction, right? So it's just delaying the choice of direction in which we differentiate. That's why the absolute covariant derivative of a tangent vector field has an extra covariant entry, this one, so that in this covariant port, we can plug in a direction vector field in which we want to differentiate. Now, we defined the covariant derivative algebraically as a derivation. Now, let's look into the geometric meaning of the covariant derivative nabla. Remember, it's meant to describe something like infinitesimal parallel transport, or the change of a vector under infinitesimal parallel transport. And therefore, it should also describe finite parallel transport if you actually integrate things up. So let's assume we defined a nabla. We defined an affine connection, that is to say, we defined a covariant derivative. How did we do that? Well, we just come up with some Christoffel symbol functions, gamma with the three indices. We just make up some functions like that. And we stipulate the two axioms. In this way, we can covariantly differentiate everything, and it describes some geometry. Right? We don't have control over that yet, what it will describe. But we can always just come up with some gammas, and it will describe something. Now, what's the geometric meaning, though? So let's assume a gamma is given. We've chosen it. Now, let's choose a path in the manifold. A path, remember, is some parameterized map into the manifold. So it takes in real numbers, which is the path parameter, and it outputs points on the manifold. And then, so here's the picture. There's the manifold, and here we have the path gamma. Here's a point P. And we have a vector field, let's say eta. And that vector field eta has some vector at this point. At every point of the manifold, eta is some vector, right? OK, so we have a manifold. We have a vector field eta on it. We choose a point, and we consider a trajectory that goes through that point in that manifold. Then we say that a vector field is orthoparallel, which is to say it's parallel to itself, along such a path, or we would say that it's parallel transported, if its covariant derivative along that path, differentiated in the direction of the tangent of the path, is vanishing. So remember that the manifold in principle doesn't have a shape, but we put a shape on it by choosing the gammas, by choosing an affine connection. We define effectively a shape of that manifold. And that shape means that if you were to travel stretching out your arm like this, you know, it would be non-trivial because, you know, it's just like going to the equator and then walking around and coming back and so on. So there would be some non-triviality of it, to it. And then we could say, well, if I do that trip, for example, down from the North Pole to the equator and then walk around the equator and then come up again, then I can keep track of in which direction my arm pointed at every step along the way, right? And that means I'm mapping out a vector field, because at every point of my trajectory, I have a vector, right? And so therefore, I have a vector field. I haven't defined it everywhere, but it's defined where my trajectory is, right? And that's the vector field which is matching my outstretched arm. Now imagine I'm traveling here on this trajectory, and my arm is stretched out in this direction. You know, it doesn't always have to point straight forward, right? I could also point like this as I go, and then the equator, and so on. And then I come back, and then I will have an extra angle, right? And then I can ask whether this vector field, eta of p, happens to be the vector field that would be parallel transported on that shape. So whenever we define a gamma, we can look for vector fields. We can try to calculate vector fields that are orthoparallel. And that, if once we find a vector field that is orthoparallel, then we know what happens as you travel that trajectory. You know what happens to that vector as it travels along that trajectory. That trajectory could be a closed trajectory, for example. And then you could look at, you know, what the parallel transport is along that. So a vector field is a vector that is being parallel transported along a particular trajectory. It is called orthoparallel if its covariant derivative in the direction of the tangent of the transport is vanishing. So a vector field is called orthoparallel. So it respects the parallel transport on that manifold, where the parallel transport is defined according to the affine connection, if the covariant derivative of the vector field doesn't change. You can probably already see how this means that the gamma is encoding the shape of the manifold. Imagine you don't know the shape of the manifold. All you have is a coordinate system, and you have these gammas and so on. Then you can come up with arbitrary trajectories. And for each of these trajectories, you calculate what the autoparallel vector fields are along this trajectory. And if you find that it's all just trivial stuff, it's all just, you know, vector fields that just look the same, then you know, oh, this is a flat space. But if the autoparallel vector fields have, you know, some rotation to it, you know, ah, there's something going on. Now, by the theory of ordinary differential equations, if all of these vector fields are smooth and the manifold is smooth and so on, then we know that there always exist autoparallel vector fields. You can always choose an initial condition here and then integrate at least a finite bit. Now, how does this look in a chart to make it explicit? So assume we have chosen an affine connection, and therefore we have implicitly put a shape on the manifold. We have given the manifold a shape. Then how does this all play out? Well, then the autoparallel equation becomes this. Here we have a contravariant vector field eta. Every vector field eta is of this form, coefficient functions times basis vectors. And we have that the path, we choose an arbitrary path on the manifold. It's parameterized by parameter values from A to B, mapped into the manifold. So this parameter might be called T. So T runs from A to B, and it traces out some path on the manifold, which in a coordinate system is xi of t. Then the tangent vector field, or the tangent vector at every point along the path, is given by the differentiation of this gamma with respect to t. So we take gamma dot of x of t. So that's d by dxk by dt, d by dxk. That's the, according to the geometric definition of tangent vector space, that's the tangent vector to a path. And what this autoparallel condition is, the condition for a vector field to be parallel transported, is that the covariant derivative of the tangent vector field in the direction of the tangent to the path has to vanish. So let's spell out the path. The path's tangent vector is this. We just calculated it. Remember that these are coefficient functions that we can pull in front. And then the eta is the vector field that we still have to determine. We don't know what these coefficient functions are. We want to find out what they might be. So far, we've simply write it as coefficient functions times the basis vectors. Then by the first axiom of an affine connection, we pull these functions in front of everything. Here they are. And then this, here we have a coefficient function, and we use the second axiom, the Leibniz rule, for covariant differentiation. And it gives us that the covariant derivative of this product of a function in the vector field is obtained by differentiating the coefficient function, and that's just the ordinary derivative, leaving that the same, plus a term where we leave the coefficient function the same, and then covariantly differentiate the basis vector, and that's where the Christoffel symbols come in. So one term where we differentiate the eta, that's this one, we differentiate the eta. And another term where we covariantly differentiate the basis vectors, that's where we get the Christoffel symbols. Then this contraction eats itself up, so we just get the eta I by dt here. And that basis vector we pull outside of the bracket, and then that basis vector we pull outside of the bracket, and we obtain this here. So what we need is that the covariant derivative is equal to 0. Since these are basis vectors, and therefore they don't vanish, what we need is that this round bracket vanishes. And now we ended up with a differential equation for the coefficient functions of the tangent vector field eta. It says that if we have a tangent vector field eta, we have to differentiate it along the path. So this is eta I of x of t, right? And we differentiate that with respect to t. Then plus the undifferentiated vector field at that same point, x of t, times the tangent vector times the Christoffel symbols equal to 0. And now we see quite clearly that the geometry here matters, because if the space was flat and we use Cartesian coordinates, then the gamma symbols would be vanishing. And as they vanish, we simply obtain that the vector field shouldn't change, right? So parallel transport is trivial. But that changes it. But remember, I'm always saying, if the space is flat and we use Cartesian coordinates, because we can always use non-Cartesian coordinate, even on flat space, and then we get gammas. Right? The presence of gamma doesn't indicate yet that there is curvature, that there is non-trivial shape. Because if you remember here, the transformation properties are this. There is a term that's proportional to gamma, but there's also this term that does not depend on gamma. So even if you, let's say you start on flat space in Cartesian coordinates, gamma is zero. That term is absent. And then you go into some funny rotating coordinates, maybe polar spherical coordinates or a carousel or whatever. Then you get that stuff. And that's giving you gammas, which makes sense, because what is a straight line and parallel transport in Cartesian coordinates, it's not a straight line at all and doesn't look like a vector field is parallel. The actual parallel transport is still described by this then, right? If you have a flat space and funny coordinates, yes, then you get a non-trivial condition on parallel transport. It's like the geometric equivalent of pseudo-forces. Okay, so what we have here is, as I mentioned before, that from the theory of ordinary differential equations, ordinary because it's just one variable with respect to which we are differentiating, that's the time variable. So it's not a partial differential equation, it's an ordinary differential equation. And if the gamma is some smooth function, and remember we get to choose the gamma by putting some shape on the manifold, then there's always a solution to this. So what that means is that given a choice of affine connection and given a choice of path in that manifold, then the auto-parallel transport of a tangent vector is unique, at least for a finite region before and after P. So we can choose our affine connection whichever way we want, but let's assume we choose it smooth. We choose a point. We choose a path through that point, then we can pick an arbitrary initial tangent vector, not tangent to the path, just any vector of the tangent space, and then we can parallel transport it along that path by using that initial direction as initial condition, and then solve this ordinary differential equation to parallel transport that vector along that path. So again, we choose the shape of the manifold by choosing the gamma, and then that tells us how to obtain the parallel transport of vectors along paths. It's done by solving this ODE, this ordinary differential equation, with whatever vector we want to parallel transport as initial condition. At that point, at that time t, let's say t equal to zero, we have a particular vector eta, and then we solve that equation for the eta I for all time, and that gives us the parallel transport of that vector along that path. This means that the path gamma, once we choose a path gamma, defines a parallel transport map tau. Right? So the parallel transport map tau depends on two times t and s, and it maps a tangent vector at the point gamma of t into a tangent vector at the point gamma of s on the trajectory. So we choose a point here. This is the manifold again. Here's our trajectory. And we now have a parallel transport map. I mean, we are assuming that we are really good at solving ODEs. And then we obtain this parallel transport map, which says that choose a point here And then you can parallel transport any arbitrary vector along that path to obtain a vector at the endpoint over there. So this parallel transport map maps tangent vectors at the point gamma of t into tangent vectors at the point gamma of s and vice versa. But that invites reconsidering how to define the covariant derivative. We did it algebraically with the axioms, but now we have parallel transport of vectors, which means we should be able to write down a Newton-Leibniz limit. And that's what we can do. We can, here's the proposition, and we won't go through the proof. For the proof, you can look it up in the text by Straumann in the appendix. If you want to covariantly differentiate a tangent vector field in the direction of a tangent vector field gamma dot, where gamma dot is the tangent vector to a trajectory, then this can be defined as d by ds at s of t of the parallel transport of eta of gamma of s. And that, of course, can be spelled out. If you write d by ds, this is a Newton-Leibniz ordinary derivative. It's like one variable only. And if you spell that out as limit epsilon going to 0 of the argument at the advanced point minus at the original point divided by the distance, you just get a Newton-Leibniz limit for this. And this gives us a geometric definition of what the covariant derivative is. The covariant derivative is just the limit of taking the point here, taking the vector here, taking the parallel transported vector there, taking their difference, and dividing by the distance and taking the limit for the distance going to 0, where the identification of vectors from one point to the next is through parallel transport. So far, we've only covariantly differentiated tangent vector fields. We would like to be able to differentiate also, covariantly differentiate also arbitrary tensors. Now, for that, we need the notion of parallel transport of arbitrary tensors. And so the parallel transport map, tau of st, transports tangent vectors, by our definition so far, from one point on a trajectory to another point on a trajectory. But we can define the parallel transport map also to parallel transport the dual vectors omega, namely in such a way that the contraction of indices, upper and lower indices, is conserved. That's an important notion that we will get to a little later, again and again. So the parallel transport of a tangent vector plugged into the parallel transport of a cotangent vector. Remember that the cotangent vector feeds on tangent vectors to output a number. So if eta is a vector and omega is a covector, then omega of eta is a number. So that is a number, omega on eta. Cotangent vector evaluates being a dual vector onto a tangent vector to give us a number. And what we say here is that if you parallel transport eta and you parallel transport omega, and then you evaluate onto another, that gives us the same. That's super important, that concept, because this is forced upon us by the idea that we want it to be parallel transport. If you have a vector, remember that if you take the evaluation of two vectors on another, like in geometry, eta and omega are two vectors, then what is the inner product? What is the evaluation of those onto each other? What it is the length of one vector times the length of the other vector times the cosine of the angle between them. And now if you take one of those vectors and parallel transport it, and you take the other vector and parallel transport it, then if you've truly parallel transported them, then you haven't changed the length of either vector, and you also haven't changed the angle between them. Because both were you know, parallel transported, so they all moved in the same direction if the direction changed. So that evaluation should stay the same, and that's what we get here. That's that condition here. So we define, because what we deal with is supposed to be parallel transport, we define the parallel transport on covariant vector fields to be simply such that, yes, the inner product remains the same. And in general then, so what this means is that it doesn't matter whether you first evaluate tangent on cotangent vectors and then parallel transport, or you first parallel transport and then evaluate on them, right? So whether you first take your tensors and parallel transport them and then form the tensor product, or you take the tensor product of two tensors and then parallel transport that, that should be the same. So we define, therefore, the covariant derivative of an arbitrary tensor field. So S, capital S, is an arbitrary tensor field with arbitrarily many contravariant and covariant indices in the direction, the covariant derivative in the direction of a tangent vector field psi. I mean, for the to choose the direction in which we differentiate, we always use a tangent vector field for that. So we covariantly differentiate a tangent vector a tensor field in the direction of a tangent vector psi. Then this is by definition, and we recruit now the geometric redefinition of what we mean by the covariant derivative. It's the covariant derivative of S in the direction of the tangent vector on a path gamma through that point P, which is such that the gamma dot, the tangent speed, so to speak, along that trajectory happens to be equal to psi. And this is defined to be the ordinary Newton-Leibniz limit of d by dt, where t is the parameter along the path, evaluated at t equal to 0, because at t equal to 0, we are supposed to be at the point P, of the parallel transport from the original point P a little bit further down the road of that tangent vector, of that tensor. So we know how to parallel transport tensors because we knew how to parallel transport tangent vectors. Then by this rule, we also found out how to parallel transport cotangent vectors. And now since we know how to parallel transport tangent and cotangent vectors, we know how to parallel transport any tensors. That's what we do here. We parallel transport an arbitrary tensor, and we take the Newton-Leibniz limit for this derivative of the parallel transport. OK, so that's the definition of the covariant derivative of an arbitrary tensor. And then we can also define the delayed choice version of this, where we say the absolute covariant derivative is the covariant derivative of that tensor is such that we can plug in our choice of of direction in which to differentiate later. So the absolute covariant derivative of S has one more covariant index. It has one more covariant degree, because that extra covariant degree is used to plug in a direction vector to differentiate into. So when we have the covariant derivative, absolute covariant derivative of an arbitrary tensor S, then it takes not only a number, let's say, p of tangent vectors, and a number of, let's say, r cotangent vectors, but it also takes another tangent vector as input, and that extra tangent vector as input fills this extra covariant degree. And what do we obtain when we plug all of these entries in here plus the direction vector? Well, we get what we defined up here, and differentiate it in the psi direction. So we take the covariant derivative of S in the psi direction. It feeds on so many tangent vectors, so many cotangent vectors, and we differentiate in the psi direction. It's just a delayed choice. So what are the properties of the covariant derivative? it is a derivation. It's a derivation on the space of tensors. So if we covariantly differentiate the tensor product of two tensor vector fields, then it is defined in this way, remember, or actually in this way in general. And because the ordinary derivative obeys the Leibniz rule, this also obeys the Leibniz rule. And we obtain that it is d by ds of, you know, the derivative of the first tensor factor, leaving the second the same, and then leaving the first tensor factor the same and differentiating the second. So we can then elegantly rewrite this in the original notation as the covariant derivative of the first tensor, and here the covariant derivative of the second tensor. So it's really a derivation, straightforwardly a derivation on the tensor space. Something important to keep in mind, because that will come up as a useful, important property throughout the course. This statement here, which is that we define the parallel transport of cotensors, of cotangent vectors, such that evaluation of a cotangent vector and a tangent vector can be done first, and then you parallel transport, or you parallel transport them first, and then you evaluate. Because of that, which we then generalize to arbitrary tensors, it means that parallel transport and contraction of indices commute. So if you have a tensor with a bunch of contravariant indices and a bunch of covariant indices, for some reason, sometimes you may want to contract some indices, get rid of some by summing over them. And then you may want to covariantly differentiate the result. Then this means that you might as well have first covariantly differentiated the whole thing and then contract it. That doesn't matter. And that's because the covariant differentiation is about parallel transport, and parallel transport is preserving the evaluation of cotangent on tangent components. It's therefore commuting with the contraction, because contraction is always evaluation of a covariant onto a contravariant index when you write it in the basis.
So is this the main reason why the covariant derivative of the metric is zero? And you haven't mentioned that yet, but
yeah.
Yes, this will be the reason.
Yes, and it will later translate into the fact that the covariant derivative of the metric is zero.
Can't do that.
Yeah, that's what it will turn into. That's right. Okay, so then how does, now that we have defined the covariant derivative on tensors, how does that look in a chart? Well, in a chart, well, first of all, remember that the covariant derivative of a basis vector field in the direction of xi is given by that expression. That was the defining property. I mean, we did it without writing the xi. We just wrote here d by dxj. But remember that these coefficient functions can be trivially pulled in front of the covariant derivative by the first axiom of the covariant differentiation. Now, the problem now is, how do we find out what the covariant derivative of not a tangent vector, but the cotangent vector is? Right? So what's the covariant derivative of dxi in the direction of xi? After all, we're already claiming we can covariantly differentiate all tensors. So we should be able to not only explicitly covariantly differentiate tangent vectors, but also cotangent vectors. And for that, we consider eta tensor omega, and we differentiate. So we differentiate this tensor here, right? It's a one-fold contravariant, one-fold covariant tensor. Then by the Leibniz rule, we differentiate this tensor omega plus. We leave that the same, and we differentiate that. This is the thing we still want to find out. We know how to differentiate tangent vectors, but we don't know how to differentiate cotangent vectors. I mean, we have implied it, but how can we do that explicitly? And now we use the fact that covariant differentiation and contraction commute. So let's just contract the whole thing. Let's evaluate the eta on the omega, or omega on the eta. In this case, this is just a scalar function here. And the covariant derivative of a scalar function is just the directional derivative of that scalar function. And on the right-hand side, we have to evaluate this on that and this on that. Actually, this is the covariant part, so technically we are evaluating omega on that tangent vector. We are evaluating this cotangent vector on that tangent vector. So therefore, we obtain by solving for this, you see, this tells us how the covariant derivative of omega in the xi direction applied to eta evaluates. Namely, this we know how to do, and that we know how to do. We know that because we know the covariant derivative of a tangent vector field. This involves the Christoffel symbols. And that's just the ordinary directional derivative of a scalar function. So indeed, we can write that the covariant derivative of a cotangent vector field in the xi direction is given by these two terms. Evaluation, ordinary directional derivative of omega of eta, and that. Now, let's choose a basis, because if we can do it on a basis, we can do it for all vector fields by the axioms. So we choose for omega dxj and for eta d by dxi. Then we have that the covariant derivative of dxi in the direction of xi, which is the thing we want to find out. How do we, namely, how do we covariantly differentiate a cotangent vector field such as this one, dxj? Acting on that, it is given by this minus that. I've just written this out. By the way, I've introduced now a notation that we don't have to introduce, but in the literature it's being used, so it's good to have it. It's basically that geometers use like a bracket notation, right? So instead of saying that we are evaluating here the omega on eta, so omega of eta, we could also write, you know, brackets, omega, it's like a bra omega and a ket eta, right? And so what this bra ket notation simply means is that this cotangent vector is eating up this tangent vector by inner product, which is just a Kronecker delta. But that's number valued, and the partial derivatives of a number are zero, because it's constant, the Kronecker delta. And we're just left with this expression, which we know how to evaluate, right? We know what the covariant derivative of a vector field is. We just get the Christoffel symbols. So overall, we get that, which means we obtain that the covariant derivative of a vector field is given by that expression. It looks very similar to what we had for a tangent vector field, except that for a tangent vector field, we had a plus here. And we had, of course, that the indices were contracted differently, because we had here a d by dxj, so it was contracting with that j over here instead of contracting with this I down there. So now we know how the cotangent and how the tangent vectors get differentiated. And from that, by linearity and the Leibniz rule, we can work out what the covariant derivative of arbitrary vectors is. And I will not bore you to death with all of these expressions. Let me just explain what the end result of it is. The end result is this, that if we consider an arbitrary tensor, you see, the calculations go straightforwardly as we did before for this. And the end result is this. An arbitrary tensor field can always be written in this form. If it has p contravariant, if it has the degree p for the contravariant nature, and it is q-fold covariant, then we have q basis vectors of cotangent spaces and p basis vectors of the tangent space. So these are all p-fold contravariant and q-fold covariant tensors, basis tensors. And these are coefficient functions. Remember, those are functions, right? That's not a tensor. These are functions. And then the covariant derivative of that tensor field in the basis, with this choice of basis, is given in the following way. It's a contraction with the xi k in front. We know that we can always pull the xi just in front because of the first axiom for the affine connection, where we can always pull the functions here in front of the covariant derivative. So we have a xi k, and then we have one term where the this is the compact notation first. So it's xi k, and then it's the covariant derivative of these coefficient functions. And here we have all these basis vectors again. But what is this, the semicolon k? The semicolon k consists, just like for a single tangent vector, it consists of, first of all, the original derivative, the ordinary partial derivative of these coefficient functions with respect to d by dxk, indicated by having just a comma, not a semicolon. And then we get plus Christoffel symbol terms for each contravariant index that we have. We get a plus Christoffel symbols. And for each covariant index that this thing has, we have minus Christoffel symbols. And then the index structure is, of course, such that each of the upper and the lower indices gets contracted with the Christoffel symbols, respectively. And so the special cases are, of this formula, special case is where we have a tangent vector field. For tangent vector field, as we said before, the covariant derivative of the coefficient functions, so this is not a j here, this is a semicolon, right? So xi I semicolon k is the ordinary partial derivative of the coefficient function with respect to the k direction. So it's d by dxk. And then the Christoffel symbols here, where nothing gets differentiated. But this thing here encodes either the use of funny coordinates. That might be one reason why this is non-zero. So non-Cartesian coordinates, even if the space is flat. Or it can also indicate the presence of curvature. And for the cotangent vector fields, the coefficient functions can also be calculated by a similar formula. And here we have omega of I and then semicolon k. It really looks like a j, but nope, it's a semicolon. Maybe you have a better way. Maybe it shouldn't have that little curve down there. Anyway, so it's omega I semicolon k. So the coefficient functions for a cotangent vector field are obtained by ordinarily differentiating them in the k direction, but then also having a term with the affine connection with a minus sign here. Okay, so overall, what did we see today? We defined the covariant derivative, first on tangent vectors, then cotangent vectors, then on all tensors. We defined it algebraically, but then also geometrically. And we saw that it defines the notion of parallel transport. So if we choose a path, then we can define, then we know what is an autoparallel vector field. We know what is parallel transport of a vector field along that path, always relative to our choice of what the affine connection is. And therefore, the non-triviality of that parallel transport should indicate the shape of the manifold. But we haven't really done that yet. So the next thing that we will do is explore how, given an affine connection, so when we've chosen some fancy functions gamma, how does the manifold look like that we actually chose then, right? Because we can put anything in there for the gammas. What kind of manifold comes out of it? And what we will find is that that manifold, if we just randomly choose some gamma functions, those manifolds are going to have curvature and also a thing called torsion, which apparently nature doesn't really use. But the math implies it. And we will find out what it takes not to have torsion. By the way, torsion is interesting because even if nature doesn't really want to do torsion, one could imagine that there should at least be quantum fluctuations around zero torsion, right? Nobody knows because we haven't measured quantum fluctuations of curvature yet. OK, so that will be the next step, namely that we derive from the affine connection what the curvature is.